All right, this is now the third in our new studies of the life and ministry of the prophet Elijah. We're in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 17. We've only covered the very first verse so far. I'll briefly rehearse what we gained from that verse in our two studies, but we're going to be in verses 2 through 6 for this morning. So I'll go ahead and read, starting in verse 1, I'll read the first 6 verses. Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word." And the word of the Lord came to him, "Depart from here and turn eastward, and hide yourself by the brook Kereth, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Kereth that is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. All right, in verse 1, what we highlighted is the significance, first of all, of Elijah's name. His name means Yahweh is my God. And his name, just like all the Bible names, have significance and meaning. Elijah's no less than anyone else in all the key figures in Scripture, and possibly even more so than many, because Elijah's name points to his specific mission. He was born and brought to the forefront in ministry by the Lord at a particularly critical moment in Israel's history. Just like Moses came on the scene at a key moment in Israel's history, Elijah did as well. Looking back from a New Testament perspective, Moses and Elijah are identified in the New Testament by their significance of being chosen by the Lord to appear to the Lord Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. Out of all of the many significant figures of the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah are identified by the Lord as the two most significant, the two most important. And it's because they're ministering at the two most critical moments in Israel's history. Moses at the beginning of Israel's story, and Elijah at the critical juncture in which Israel has begun, not just begun, but has been for a period of time, drifting from the Lord into idolatry and the worship of false gods, mixing the true worship of the Lord with the worship of the gods worshiped by the nations surrounding them. And the particular god that is false god, of course, that's being worshiped at this particular time is the god Baal. He was the storm god, the rain god. He was being worshiped by the people, even among Israel, because they viewed him as the source of their fertility, the source of their harvest, the source of their food and their crops. And because of this corruption and idolatry that's going on in Israel, the Lord has raised Elijah up, his mission captured again by his name, Yahweh is my God. His point, or the reason why the Lord has called him to minister, is to display in to all of the people that are drifting from the Lord that there is only one true God, and Yahweh is his name, and his ministry is going to be marked by this sequence of confrontations between the worshipers of the false gods and Elijah, the representative servant, the prophet, the messenger of the one true God. In this very first verse, we don't have the backstory of Elijah's mission. We just have him beginning his mission, and he begins it with a bang in a confrontation, a direct confrontation with the king, King Ahab. And King Ahab, we spent some time looking at his backstory. He's an ungodly man. He is not a one who honors and recognizes the Lord. He is a worshiper of Baal, and he is, along with his wife Jezebel, he is the promoter of false gods in Israel. And Elijah is sent to him. He confronts him. He proclaims boldly, courageously, because, of course, Ahab on a natural level had the authority and the power to end Elijah's life, but he confronts Ahab with a proclamation of the Lord's judgment, and the specific judgment that's proclaimed is there's going to be no rain in the land, and that judgment is going to last for 3 years. With no rain, there will be no crops that will grow, and the result is going to be there's going to be famine in the land. And we saw that this judgment is very specific and targeted, meaning it is targeting the very thing that the hearts of the people of Israel were compromising in, because they're worshiping a false god of rain, and so God is demonstrating his superiority over this false god by ending the rain, no matter what they do to call out to Baal to send rain to provide their crops. The Lord is going to, through Elijah's word, is going to bring an end to the rain until they learn the hard lesson that they need to learn. Now, that leads us here up to verse 2, of course, and we see the word of the Lord came to him. So immediately following his confrontation of Ahab, Elijah receives a new word from the Lord, and in this word there's a very specific direction or a clear guidance, a special guidance from the Lord, in which the Lord tells him in verse 3, depart from here. And of course he had gone to Ahab to confront him. Depart from here, turn eastward, and hide yourself by the brook Kereth, which is east of the Jordan. Now, I'm going to call this an unusual guidance, and it's unusual in the sense that it's somewhat unexpected. It might not be what we would expect the Lord to say to him or direct him to do at this particular point in the story. The first question is, what the Lord tells him, not just leave this location, but he tells him to go and hide yourself by this brook Kereth, which is on the far side, the east side of the River Jordan. The question is, why should he hide himself? He's identified himself in verse 1 as a man before whom I stand, speaking of his relationship to the Lord. He, in his boldness and courage to confront Ahab, basically put his life on the line and said, I belong to the Lord. The Lord's watching over me. He's in charge of me. And no matter what you may want to do to me because I have proclaimed the word of the Lord's judgment to you, I am standing before the Lord. My life belongs to him. And, of course, the Lord honored his boldness. He honored his faithfulness. He honored his courage. And the Lord preserved him. But why would the Lord now tell him to go hide himself? It's an unusual thing. Why wouldn't he, after his great, in a sense, spiritual victory of proclaiming this word of judgment to Ahab, why wouldn't the Lord send him on a preaching tour throughout the land of Israel to not just tell Ahab this word of judgment, but to go and visit each town and village throughout the region and to rehearse the message of the Lord and call the people to himself? But instead, the Lord tells him, go and hide yourself. Instead of increasing his ministry to a greater extent, he's actually commanding him to reduce his ministry and to go for an unknown period of time. And what we're going to find out is the period of time that he's going to be hiding himself is going to equal the amount of time that's connected to the judgment that he's just proclaimed. We learn from the New Testament that this judgment lasts for over 3 years. This drought, this no rain judgment lasts for 3 years. Elijah is being commanded by the Lord to go into hiding for a 3-year period. He's not told right up front how long, but that's how long he's going to be, in a sense, out of the public eye and behind the scenes in hiding. So, number one, what we can assume is that Ahab's not going to be thrilled with the judgment that has just been proclaimed on the land. In fact, later in one of the scenes of interaction between Elijah and Ahab, Ahab refers to Elijah as, you troubler of Israel. And so Ahab is going to be targeting Elijah as the focal point of the troubles in his kingdom. And of course, he's not thrilled with Elijah. And not only Ahab, but his wife Jezebel is not going to be thrilled with Elijah as well. And so the Lord removes him from the scene for, number one, his own protection. Now, the Lord is capable, fully capable of protecting him right there in front of the king, and yet the Lord also will at times direct his servants to use wisdom and to remove themselves from persecuting circumstances. We see this displayed in the ministry of the Lord Jesus in one circumstance where he was the target of the anger and the wrath of those that opposed his ministry. We're told that the Lord Jesus hid himself from them. We see this displayed in the life of the Apostle Paul and in his ministry. One circumstance where they were those that were seeking to kill Paul, he was lowered by a basket over the city wall at night so that he could escape from that city and go on and minister in other places. So God is fully capable of protecting his servants by supernatural means, but he's also capable of directing them to wisely remove themselves from circumstances of persecution, unless enduring that persecution and being in that circumstance of persecution is serving the Lord's greater purpose. So if you're in a situation where your life is in danger only because you represent the Lord may, in that situation, direct you to remove yourself from the circumstance wisely, guarding your own life and not putting it in unnecessary circumstances of danger. Second, in this three-year period where he's going to be hiding himself from the people, from the king, from public ministry, what's happening here is not just there's going to be a famine of physical food, but because Elijah is at this point in time really the only spokesperson for the Lord in the land of Israel, the only one that is really communicating the word of the Lord, this is part of the Lord's judgment upon the nation. There's going to be, for this same three-year period when Elijah is, in a sense, hiding from public ministry, he is going to be the focal point of what we could call a famine of the word of the Lord. It's not just that the people aren't receiving rain, and not just that their crops aren't growing, but they're not going to hear any word from the Lord for as long as Elijah is absent from the scene and hiding by the brook Kerith. And the next question I think that is implied here in this direction of the Lord, depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Kerith, which is east of the Jordan. Why this particular spot? There are a lot of locations in Israel that the Lord could have directed him to and could have had him hide in, but why this spot and why specifically a spot east of the River Jordan? That should, in all of our perspectives, those of us who are familiar with the Old Testament accounts of the Lord's dealing with his people, it should spark a point of remembrance for us. What's significant about the River Jordan in the history of God's dealing with his old covenant people, Israel? What's the significance of the River Jordan?
Crossing the entrance into the promised
land. Absolutely. It's the boundary line that symbolized and still did to this day the beginning of the fulfillment of the Lord's promise that was made all the way back to their first forefather, Abraham, in which the Lord led him to a land of promise. And when eventually that promise was fulfilled through the ministry of Moses, and remember, we're connecting throughout the story of Elijah, the ministry of Moses and the ministry of Elijah, because they are very much intricately spiritually connected. When the Lord fulfilled his promise to his people through Moses, of course, the children of Israel were rescued from Egypt, rescued from the domination of Pharaoh. The Lord brought them across the Red Sea, brought them into the wilderness. They journeyed for that 40-year time period, making circles, in a sense, through the wilderness. But at the end of that 40-year period, when the time came in which the Lord led the children of Israel into the promised land, he brought them on the far eastern shore of the River Jordan. He brought them to the very verge of the promised land. And then under the ministry of Joshua, he led them across the River Jordan, crossing from east to west. And as soon as their feet hit that western shore of the River Jordan, they're now in the promised land. And so the Lord now leads Elijah back across, going the opposite direction, back across the River Jordan. And he, as he sets his foot on the eastern shore of the river, symbolically, he is no longer in the land of promise. He is now where? He's in the wilderness, just like Israel was before the Lord brought the children of Israel into the promised land. Now, what this signifies is, this is what we could call a second wilderness journey of the people of Israel, but represented symbolically by one single faithful man, the prophet Elijah. And so in this sense, Elijah is functioning as a second Moses. He's functioning as a new Moses. The symbol here, or the point here, is that because Israel has been so unfaithful to the Lord is removing them under judgment from the land of promise. And the only reason he had given them that blessing to begin with was because of the faithfulness of Abraham. And so he's removing that blessing from them. He's removing them from the promised land. He's taking them back into the wilderness. And it's like saying, we're starting this all over again. You guys, I brought you in. I blessed you. I overflowed your lives with blessings. But you ignored me. You disregarded me. You disobeyed me. And you dishonored me. And so we're going to have to start all over again. I'm clearing the decks. I'm taking it back to basics. I'm taking you back to the wilderness. I'm taking you back to the starting point. And we're going to start this promised land thing all over again from the beginning point. And we're going to rebuild from here. And so he brings Elijah into the wilderness. Now, of course, there's something that happened during Israel's wilderness journey that we're all very, very familiar with. And that, in a sense, is going to spiritually and symbolically, even though it's a real event, there's spiritual symbolism going on here. It's going to be replayed. How did the Lord provide for his people during their wilderness journey? He rained in a miracle. He rained manna upon their camp every day, 6 days a week, for the entire duration of their time in the wilderness, which was, as we've already identified, a 40-year-long time period, an extended, consistent, and regular display of the Lord's miraculous provision. And so if Elijah is functioning as a new Moses, if he's been appointed by the Lord to, in a sense, replay the story of the wilderness journey of Israel, it's only appropriate that the Lord would do a similar kind of miracle, different details, different circumstance, but the same kind of spiritual display of the Lord's miraculous provision. And so he does it this way. In verse 4, the Lord speaks to him after directing him to go to Kereth, east of the Jordan. Verse 4, you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So there's a twofold special provision of the Lord for him in his wilderness spot there at the brook Kereth. One is a provision of water. Two is a provision of food. And just like Israel in the wilderness was given a double provision, manna rained from heaven upon them, as we said, on a daily basis. And the Lord, of course, brought water from the rock and provided water for the entire nation of Israel to drink throughout their wilderness journeys. The Lord is providing both water and food for Elijah in this circumstance, patterned after the wilderness provision of the Lord to his people in that earlier generation. And he goes on to describe in verse 5, so he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith that is east of the Jordan. And then verse 6, we're given some additional detail, and it's not unimportant. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. We're all familiar with ravens. The closest we have in our physical circumstances is the crows that are all around us in our city here. Similar kind of bird. I don't know if they're exactly identical, but very similar. Crows are not the, I don't know what your opinion is of crows, but they're not my favorite bird of all the birds that fly in the heavens. And if the Lord had ordained to provide for me through one of the birds, I think I would have chosen a different bird than the raven to come and bring me my daily provision. But the Lord chose ravens, and it's interesting that he did so. Let's look for a moment back. You can keep your place in 1 Kings. We'll probably come back here. Leviticus chapter 11. Let's read verses 13 through 15. This is part of a larger section. We don't need all the details that are revealed here, but this is a portion of God's law in which the Lord is identifying for his people Israel the categories of what are known as the clean and the unclean animals. These are identified as ceremonially clean and unclean, not just physically clean and unclean. And these all bear spiritual and symbolic significance, not just physical significance. But the idea was that there were certain animals that the Lord allowed his people to eat and certain animals that were forbidden for them to eat. And so we're just reading a small portion of this as the Lord begins to describe the differences in the birds of the air. Leviticus 11:13. And these you shall detest among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are detestable. The eagle, the bearded vulture, the black vulture, the kite, the falcon of any kind, every raven of any kind. And then he goes on from there and describes a few others of the detestable birds. So I just wanted us to catch and see very clearly that from a biblical perspective, from a God's law of Moses perspective, the ravens fit into the category of unclean birds, and the Lord goes out of his way to teach his people how they are to view these birds, the opinion they're to form about them. For instance, like in our culture, United States of America, we've chosen a particular bird of the heavens to symbolize our nation. What bird have we chosen? The eagle. And we view the eagle as a noble bird, right? Because it's large and it's dominant among the birds, and it, you know, it's beautiful in its flight, and it's actually physically a beautiful bird. But here the Lord includes it among the unclean birds and says, you shall detest it, and it is a detestable bird. That has to do with its habits, not so much its physical form, what it looks like, how it flies, but the way it lives its life symbolizes a detestable spiritual principle that the people of God were meant to learn from. And I'm just using the eagle because of how we as a culture use the eagle in our symbolism. But here included in this list in verse 15, every raven of any kind. So the raven was, from childhood until this point in Elijah's life, in his mind, in his perspective, in his spiritual and religious training, it was a detestable bird. It was an unclean bird. And, of course, that meant you were to never kill one of these birds with the intention of making a meal of it. But it's very interesting that the Lord chooses one from the list of unclean and detestable birds to be the carrier of his daily food provision. Now, there are other birds the Lord could have chosen from the better list. He could have chosen doves to fly on a daily basis and provide him his food. We might expect him to choose doves because of how doves are symbolically used in a much more favorable sense in Scripture elsewhere. But the Lord doesn't choose doves. So the question I want to ask, and I think we're meant to ask in this circumstance, is why would he choose ravens? Well, the idea here, of course, is that Israel itself is under the judgment of the Lord. And the Lord is using even the circumstances of Israel's judgment to display the distinction the Lord is making between those who are faithful among his people and those who are unfaithful among his people. And so even under a circumstance of judgment, the Lord can use the circumstance of judgment as represented by a raven here, an unclean, detestable bird, to be a vehicle or an avenue of the Lord's display of faithful, even miraculous provision for his servant Elijah, the prophet of the Lord. So what is going to happen here is as Elijah obeys the word of the Lord, and he goes out and finds this location, the brook Kereth, on the far side of the eastern shore of the river Jordan. As he's there, the Lord is sending in what most of you are too young to remember this, but back all the way back in the 1960s, there was a circumstance where the city of Berlin was isolated due to an issue with the USSR, and the United States Air Force did a supply drop to the city of Berlin and sent plane after plane so that the inhabitants of the city of Berlin didn't starve. Does anybody remember that, or maybe you've read about it in history? This is a much smaller scale, of course, and instead of planes, you've got ravens flying. And they're bringing in, though, a daily supply drop to Elijah. So I just want you to put yourself in his sandals for a moment. You're now camped out. There's no Hilton Inn there at the Brook Cherith. It's not like some resort in the desert. He is just sent there to this brook, this small river there on the far side of the River Jordan. He's camping there. He doesn't have special equipment or gear. He probably just showed up with the clothes on his back. And of course, we know he had rough clothing from descriptions elsewhere in Scripture. He arrives there. He's probably got a staff, and that's it. No gear, and he's camped there. And now here come ravens flying in. And they're flying in on a schedule. It's not a random flight. It's not just, that was strange. That was somewhat coincidental. They're coming in on schedule. They're coming in every morning, and then there's a lull, and then here they come again at evening time. And each time they come in, they're bringing the same exact thing. And where are they how are they bringing this food? So it says, the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Well, there's only two ways that a raven can bring bread and meat. How are they bringing it? It's either in their claws, as they're flying, because they're using their wings to fly. So they either have the bread and meat in their claws, or they have it in their beak. And we don't know between those two options which detail. Maybe it was both. But they're flying in, and we don't know if they're actually landing right in front of him and dropping the food, or whether I tend to think, and this is just supposition on my part, that they're flying directly overhead and like a bomber just dropping their payload right on his head, raining bread and meat on him like Israel received manna raining on their camp on a daily basis, every morning and every evening. So the Lord is miraculously providing for him, but it's not even what we would call three square meals a day. it's two slightly rounded meals a day. There's the basics. There's protein, meat, and there's carbs, bread, and water to drink. And as you can imagine, he's there for a period of time. We don't know the exact amount of time. Some commentators think he was at the Brook Kerith for 1 year before he moved to his next location in our next study that we'll see. Some people think he was there closer to the full 3 year period, but he wasn't there for a day and he wasn't there for a week. He was there for an extended camping trip. Now, I don't know about you. I enjoy camping, but after, I don't know, a week, couple of weeks out in the wilderness, I'm usually ready to return to the comfort of home. And I don't mind eating camp food, especially if you packed in some really nice food. I had a camping trip with a friend of mine years and years ago. The two of us hiked up into the High Sierras together, and I packed very efficiently. I had good gear, and I had some freeze-dried food. You know, they had just invented freeze-dried food back in those days, and so I had some freeze-dried food packed in my pack, and I had some nuts and dried fruit and stuff like that that wasn't too heavy a load. And I was trucking up this grade as we were heading to this high mountain lake, and my friend, who was actually in just as good a shape as I was, if not better, was struggling and really suffering on the trail. And at a certain point, I could just tell his backpack was killing him. And I asked him, "What's the problem? How are you doing? You know, can I help you? Can I take some of your load? Because I seem to be doing fine." He said, "Yeah, maybe if we could split the load a little bit." So he opened his backpack, and his entire backpack was full of cans of food that he had taken out of the cupboard. He had never gone on such an extended hiking trip before, because we were planning on being there for a week or two. And so he had just raided the pantry, and he had cans of, you know, SpaghettiOs and pork and beans. And that stuff is heavy. I don't know if you've ever tried to load a pack with canned goods and then hike up, you know, a mountain pass. But, you know, you just can't do that kind of stuff. And that's why they have freeze-dried food. It's the moisture in the food that causes it to be extra heavy. So in a circumstance like this, Elijah is in a situation where the Lord is providing for him, but it's not a provision of, you know, I can think of better ways, is what I want to say, of eating than how he was going to eat for this next year. It was the simple, basic necessities of life that the Lord was providing for him. Enough protein to survive and to do well, enough carbohydrate to survive and do well, but it's not like he was sitting down at some all-you-can-eat buffet table and eating, you know, anything and everything he could ever want. It was just the basics that the Lord was providing for him. And not even three times a day. This is not breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The Lord was providing breakfast for him, and the Lord was providing dinner for him. And you deal with that, and you live on that, and you better be satisfied with that, because there was no other food to be had anywhere else in the story. This is the Matthew chapter 6, the Lord's prayer principle in real action. You know, give us this day our daily bread. And the Lord is providing for him exactly that way. Now, this story is very near and dear to my heart in terms of my own personal experience. I want to share with you, and I've shared this story before, and some of you may remember it, a couple of you may have never heard this story before, but the Lord used this story in my life, this circumstance of what Elijah passed through, in a very, for me, a very personal way, in a way that really spoke to my life at a moment when I needed to hear from the Lord. I was a much younger man. I knew the Lord. I was walking with the Lord. And I was in a circumstance where I was in between jobs. I had lost a job through a circumstance with the business where the business folded. And I was looking for work, but it just seemed I couldn't. The door for a new job was not opening up in front of me. And of course, I was praying for the Lord's provision. I was asking for the Lord's direction. And I got a very clear sense of leading from the Lord. I was at the time living up in Topanga Canyon. And I, through a friend and through an acquaintance, a brother in the Lord, had heard about an opportunity in Moorpark, in which there was an opportunity for me to go and to function as kind of a house sitter for a small attorney business, a law firm that was set up in a small home, a house that had been turned into an office there in Moorpark. And during the day, the attorneys worked in the, they had turned the bedrooms into their offices. And at night, they went to their own homes, but they were concerned to leave the house empty, and they wanted someone to stay there during the night to function as a kind of a security guard slash house sitter. And so I heard about this opportunity, but it wasn't a paying job. It was, you can live there for free if you will sleep there at night and function as a security guard. So I didn't have any other opportunities where I was living. And I thought, okay, I will trust the Lord. And I prayed and sensed that the Lord was leading me in that direction. So I went and lived in this house in Moorpark. And I had just a few dollars left from my last paycheck at my last job. And I thought, well, I've tried everything I can think of where I'm living to find a job. Maybe I can find a job in Moorpark while I'm living there. And so I went and I began to stay there at night. And during the day, they had an attorney's office. So I would get up early in the morning, get dressed, and I would go out and I would start knocking on doors throughout Moorpark in all of the places of business, looking to see if I could find work, find a job. So I was there for approximately 2 weeks, and I had knocked on every door in the city of Moorpark. Back then, Moorpark was a much smaller town than it is today. It's much more developed today. And every place that I knocked, you know, it just seemed like, no, I'm sorry, we don't have any openings, can't use you, we can't hire you. And at the end of that 2 weeks, the few dollars that I had left from my last paycheck were gone, because I was using that, of course, to eat. And so here I am, 2 weeks in, I have a place to live, and I had a clear sense that the Lord had led me there. And I was knocking faithfully on every door looking for work, and there was no work. And it came to the next day, my last dollar had been used up, and I'm in a circumstance where, what am I going to eat today? I don't have any money. I don't have any food. I'm hungry. How am I going to eat? And there were no more doors to knock on. And I was allowed to drink coffee from the coffee pot there. So I made myself coffee in the morning, getting ready to go out and look for more doors to knock on. And I was standing in the back yard of this house, and I was drinking my coffee, and I was praying, and I was just crying out to the Lord, Lord, you know, you're going to have to provide for me, because I don't know how I'm going to survive here in this circumstance. And I looked out into the yard, and there was a tangerine tree out in the backyard. And it was just that time of year when the full harvest of tangerines was on the tree. This thing was literally loaded with tangerines. And I hadn't had anything to eat that morning, and I thought, you know, tangerines. So I went in and asked the attorney, because they had just arrived, do you mind if I, you know, pick some fruit from the tangerine tree to eat? And he said, no, we never touch the tree. You're welcome to any of the fruit on the tree that you want to eat. So I went out that morning for breakfast, and I picked myself 10 nice, juicy tangerines, because I was hungry. And I ate those 10 tangerines, and man, that was the most delicious breakfast. And I was thankful for the Lord's provision. And I went out and knocked on doors that day, and got the same answer that I had gotten each day before. And I came back that night, and the attorneys had gone home for the night. And I'm hungry, because you know how it is. Tangerines are delicious if they're ripe, but they don't last very long. It's not like a satisfying all day long kind of provision. So I was hungry. I hadn't had any lunch. And I'm like, what shall I have for dinner? And my mind turns to the tangerine tree in the backyard. So I went out and I picked myself 10 more tangerines for dinner. And I ate those 10 tangerines. And it wasn't quite as satisfying as my breakfast, but it was still satisfying, and I was thankful to have something in my stomach. And then the next day rolls around, and I don't want to bore you with the repetition effect of the story, but for the next 10 days, what I ate for my daily provision was I ate a breakfast of tangerines, which then turned into me stopping by the house for lunch, and I would have tangerines for lunch. Then I'd go back out, and then I'd come home for dinner, and I had tangerines for dinner. And this went on for 10 days until I was systematically working my way up the tree, you know, as I could reach tangerines. And the only tangerines at the end of the 10-day period that were left on the tree were the very top branches that I couldn't reasonably reach with any measure of physical safety. I had ransacked this tangerine tree. And during the process, this is 10 days where I ate only tangerines. It wasn't like I went into this with a idea of, you know what, I'm going to do a special fast unto the Lord. You know, I'm going to seek the Lord and I'm only going to eat tangerines for 10 days. It wasn't my choice to only eat tangerines. It was what the Lord saw fit to provide for me for those 10 days. And by the grace of God, my heart was able to reach a place where by the end of the 10 days, I wasn't grumbling about, you know, how the children of Israel were in the wilderness. You know, the first day that manna was there, it was like, wow, a miracle. This is bread from heaven. This is wonderful. What does this taste like? This is so new. This is so wonderful. And then it wasn't very long after that that, what, more manna? That's all we have to eat is manna. That's all the Lord is providing for us. But by the grace of God, throughout the 10-day period, I was in a good place of, Lord, I'm thankful that you provided the tangerines for me. I'm sure this is serving your purpose in my heart and in my life, not just for my physical body. But at the same time, at the end of the 10 days, I'm thinking, you know, the trees, the trees running out, number one, my stomach, you know, is starting to need something besides just tangerines. I was losing weight. I was feeling good, but it was clear that there needed to be something else. And it was right at the end of that 10-day period that the Lord opened up a job situation for me. And it was exactly to the day for me where I couldn't reach any more tangerines that a door opened for me and I was able to return to full-time employment and I was able to return to a normal kind of working situation. Now, here's the thing for me. The Lord, I was certain, I was confident that the Lord had led me to this situation. It wasn't a situation where I went there in order to eat tangerines, but I went to where I believed the Lord was leading me. I was praying, I was seeking the Lord, I was trusting the Lord, I was, in my own perspective, obeying the Lord by going, and while I was there, the Lord provided for me. But what he provided was not a buffet table. It was a tangerine table. In other words, it was just the basic necessities. It wasn't even bread and meat. You know, it was about 6 days into the tangerines, I would have loved some bread and meat, even had ravens been dropping them. But it was what the Lord chose to provide for me, and it was more than enough for my actual need. Got me through the circumstance, and my physical circumstance was sustained, and my heart learned and gained some things from the Lord in the entire experience. So the idea here is this. This is a special story, obviously. You and I will never be in the circumstance that Elijah is in terms of identical situations, identical circumstances. But there is a pattern here, a lesson to be learned here, that absolutely will and does apply to each one of our lives. And it applies in the Lord's timing, and it applies according to his plan and purpose for you. We can't ordain these kind of situations for ourselves. But when the Lord does set you into a Brook Kereth kind of situation, you need to have your heart ready to see it, to embrace it, to trust him in it, and to walk with him through that circumstance. The idea here, or the principle behind this, is when the Lord leads you to a place in your life. Now, I'm not just talking about you wake up one day and you're in a place, but when you know that the Lord has led you into a circumstance, He's led you to a place, then you need to recognize that the Lord will always faithfully provide for you where He leads you to be. And that's exactly what Elijah's story was. It was most certainly my experience during my tangerine adventure. So, how does this apply? I'm just going to give you three examples, but the examples don't cover the fullness of how this principle might apply to your life. If the Lord leads you into a marriage, meaning He's appointed for you to be married to a specific woman and for you to commit your life and your heart to her, will the Lord faithfully provide for you in that relationship if you look to Him, if you obey Him, if you trust in Him? Will the Lord be able to meet all of your personal, physical, social, relational needs in that circumstance of life? And the answer is, if the Lord led you into that marriage, the Lord is most surely able to more than sufficiently provide your needs in that circumstance. If the Lord leads you to a church where you have been praying and seeking the Lord, and He guides your steps to a specific fellowship, then most certainly the Lord is able to provide for you and yours what is needed in that circumstance, and He will faithfully make sure you have what you need in that situation. If the Lord leads you into a job situation where it's not just I'm working random jobs, but I'm seeking the Lord. Lord, what do You want me to do with my life's work? What do You want me to do to provide for myself and my family? The Lord opens a door in front of you and you have a sense that the Lord led you into that circumstance, then you can trust that the Lord will faithfully provide for you in that situation. Now, in all three of these examples, I'm not saying that the Lord is going to provide for you a buffet table. He may. The Lord is good and He's gracious, and at times He overflows His provision for your life. But it may be as meager and as just enough to meet your bare necessities as bread and meat every morning, bread and meat every evening, and water, fresh living water to drink from the brook. Let me give you another example from my own personal life story. There was a time years ago, this is back in 1988, when I was married. I was living with my wife in the city of Moorpark. I was back to Moorpark now. We were living in a very reasonable dwelling place in terms of financially. We had a home in a triplex unit, and we were paying, this is 1988 now, so it's a few years ago, but we were paying for our rent, and we were comfortable and we were happy where we were living. We were paying for our rent $300 a month. Can you imagine paying $300 a month for, you know, an entire living situation? And we were happy there and had no plans to move. We were part of a good and healthy church out in the Thousand Oaks area. And so we would drive from Moorpark to Thousand Oaks for Sunday service and for the other fellowship opportunities of church life there. And it was during that period of time that Chatsworth Christian Church, which what is now, of course, Tree of Life, was started and founded and began. And in praying for the beginning of the church, the Lord very clearly directed me, gave me a special guidance that Sandy and I were to move from Moorpark and to come down and be part of this new church work that the Lord was establishing here in the Chatsworth area. And I had a very clear sense from the Lord as I was praying that we weren't just to drive from Moorpark to be part of the church, but we were to move to be closer to the heart of the church, to be closer to the hub of church life and activity. And so that would require for us to give up our nice, cushy $300 a month rent and to find some place down in the Chatsworth area to live. So I began to search. with the sense of the Lord's direction for where we could live. And literally, this is all the way back in 1988, but prices were not so low in the Chatsworth area then. The cheapest place I could find was $1,000 a month. So for me, it would be tripling my financial obligation to provide for my family to move from Moore Park to the Chatsworth area. And I was living on a budget. I was working as a security guard at the time, and I was going back to college in order to finish up a degree circumstance that would allow me to move forward in a new career direction. And I couldn't afford $1,000 a month. And I looked at our numbers, and I came to the conclusion that the absolute maximum that I could afford without going into debt would be $800 a month. And even that would be tightening the belt and stretching the budget to its outermost. But I had a very clear sense that we were supposed to move, and we were to be part of this new church work that was starting. And so I discussed it with my wife. I told her, we're going to be doing this. The Lord's going to open a door. We're going to be moving. She wasn't thrilled about the idea, but she was willing to follow my sense of the Lord's lead. And so I looked, and I visited so many places. And as I said, the cheapest I could find, $1,000 a month. And we found a place for $1,000 that we both loved. And we entered into a discussion with the owner of the house. It was a house rental. And in that discussion, the owner of the house said, you know what? I really like you, and I would love for you guys to come and live in my home. I just have a good sense about you. And I said, you know, I would love to live here too, but I'm not sure I can meet the $1,000 a month. He said, well, how about $800 a month? Can you afford that? When that, of course, was the uppermost limit of what we could afford. So we moved in under an agreement of $800 a month. I wasn't sure and confident that we'd be able to do that, but the Lord provided for us to be able to make that $800 a month. That was 1988. We've been here in the Chatsworth area. We're now 2016. That's 18 years later. And the Lord has provided all the way along. And it's not that my financial circumstance has increased a lot since 1988 till the present time. My income is pretty much level to where it was in 1988. And I don't know if you guys have checked on the difference in terms of just cost of living between then and now. I looked on Google as part of the preparation for this message. You know what the price of gas per gallon was in 1988 here in the Chatsworth area? It was $1.10 a gallon in 1988. And right now it's hovering right in the $3 a gallon vicinity. And it's not like gas is the only thing that's increased since that time. A cost of living across the board, of course, has increased, doubled, or if not tripled in that time. And yet somehow, some way, because I trusted in the Lord's leading, I had a clear sense that the Lord was guiding our steps to this location for His purpose, for His kingdom, for the mission that He had given me, the assignment that He had given to me. The Lord has somehow, some way provided bread and meat every morning, bread and meat every evening, and water to drink beside. And here I am. I'm not suffering. I'm being sustained by the Lord, just like your lives are being sustained by the Lord. And it's the Lord's faithfulness, and it's the Lord's provision to have done so. Cherith or Cherith represents to us what we could call, and we studied through this as a church. We spent a whole year doing this a couple of years ago in the life of Abraham and the testimony of the children of Israel. It's a test of faith and a test of obedience to be assigned to go to a place like Cherith and to camp out there and to trust that you're not going to starve to death there, that somehow, some way, the Lord is going to make a provision to faithfully provide for you what you need if you're where He wants you to be, if you're doing what He wants you to be doing. So let me just summarize with these five points, main points, the key principles of what we would call the Brook Cherith circumstance in Elijah's life as it applies to us. First, discern the Lord's leading for your life. It's not just, okay, everything that the Lord did for him would work anywhere and everywhere he might go. Looking back at the text, this is what the Lord said to him. The word of the Lord came to him, depart from here and turn eastward. Hide yourself by the brook Kirith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook. And I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. The idea is, as Elijah left one location, if he had gone to any other location in Israel, other than the brook Kerith, and had hidden himself in any other spot, he would have starved to death. Because it's not just that the Lord did a miracle in providing for him bread and meat by raven drop, but that he provided it for him in that one specific location. The Lord basically said, you need to get yourself to the brook Kerith because the ravens are already flying there. They're not flying anywhere else. They're not dropping it on all the locations in Israel. They're dropping it on this one location. It's like the miracle of the manna for Israel in the wilderness. The Lord faithfully, miraculously rained manna for the 40 years in the wilderness. But understand this. It wasn't manna raining on the entire region of the wilderness. It was manna raining on wherever the camp of Israel was. And the camp moved from location to location as they were led by the pillar of fire and cloud. So wherever the pillar of fire camped, they would set up camp around that location, and the manna that day would rain on that location, not where they had just been and not where they were about to go next. It was on where they were currently located, because that's where the Lord had targeted his miraculous provision for them. So first, you have to discern the Lord's leading. You have to know that where you're at is where the Lord wants you to be. And you need to get yourself there. And of course, once you're there, you need to trust that the Lord will provide for you. Not just today, but he'll provide for you tomorrow and the next day and the day after that. You don't need to concern yourself or bother yourself with worrying about the future. Now, this doesn't apply if you're in disobedience, if you're not being faithful, if you're not doing the things that you should be doing. Because there's two parts of the miracle here. One is we've got the miraculous bread and meat dropping from the ravens, but he has a brook there that he's supposed to drink from. It's not like the water is jumping out of the brook into his mouth. He still has to go and drink from the brook as well. And so there may be some practical thing that the Lord has you doing to provide for yourself, but nevertheless, you have to trust in the Lord's provision once you're in the location that he has led you to. Three, you have to learn how, as Paul taught us in the book of Philippians, you'll have to learn how to be content with what the Lord does provide for you. I had to learn to be content with tangerines for 10 days. And I'm still learning how to be content with what the Lord is currently providing for me as gas prices are continuing to rise and everything else in the cost of living around me. And I have to adjust my use of the Lord's resources according to what he provides. It's not like I will use resources any way I see fit and the Lord's just going to have to make up the difference. It's I have to trust that what the Lord provides for me is sufficient for me. And I have to learn in my heart how to be content with what he provides. Number four, once you're in the location where he wants you and he is providing for you and he's sending the ravens to drop it on you, don't run away from the Lord's provision. There will come a time, as we see in the next story of Elijah's life, there will come a time for him to leave the brook Kerith and to move to a new location. But until the Lord leads him on, if he were to have left this brook before the Lord said for him to leave, he would be leaving the life-sustaining provision of the Lord that was sent to that one spot and that one spot only. I could tell you countless stories of brothers and sisters in the Lord that I know that have run away from from the Lord's miraculous provision in their life because they thought the grass was somehow greener on the other side of the brook, and leaving the one location that the Lord had led them to for their life-sustaining provision. And then number five, camp until the Lord gives you a clear and new direction. Don't be in a hurry to move on. Camp until the Lord says it's time to break camp and move forward. And we'll see in verses 7 and 8, we stopped at verse 6, but in verses 7 and 8, there comes a moment when the Lord gives a new direction and a new clear provision is going to unfold in front of him. But for the time of his time at Kereth, he's to stay there, he's to camp there, he's to trust the Lord there, he's to continue to obey the Lord there, he is to be content there, and he's to not run away to some other location. All right, we'll stop there in our study through Elijah's life, and Lord willing, next month we'll pick up in verses 7 and 8 as the Brook Kereth story comes to an end, and his path takes him to Zarephath. All right? Lord bless you this morning.